I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. How are they going to do it? With 6 days left, how are Barack Obama and John McCain going to win over voters in key battleground states, such as the previously all-red Missouri, where the race is still too close to call, or the blue state of Pennsylvania, where Obama is leading in the polls, but the McCain campaign says it's gaining ground? Even Governor Ed Rendell, a Democrat who backs Obama, says he doesn't really believe Obama has the double-digit lead that some polls have been giving him there. Well, let's check in on the campaign trail. Joe Manis is political reporter for the St. Louis Dispatch in Missouri. Joe, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for asking me.
And Dennis Roddy is a staff writer covering politics for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in Pennsylvania. Hi to you as well, Dennis.
Pleasure to be with you, Robin.
And Joe, let's start in St. Louis. You've told us the race there is tight, tight, tight. Your paper endorsed Barack Obama, calling him the only transformational candidate in the race. John McCain was called the incredible shrinking man. Today, McCain is campaigning elsewhere and saying that his military background makes him better prepared to be president. Tomorrow, Obama, Biden, and Palin head to your state. So set the scene there, Joe. How are voters feeling?
Well, I think voters here, just like nationally, they're concerned about the economy. They're concerned about health care. Health care is a big issue in Missouri. We have a slightly older population than the nation as a whole, and it's a big deal. A lot of people lost their coverage a couple years ago when the state made a lot of Medicaid cuts, hurt rural Missouri. So people are really concerned about those two issues, plus the Iraq War. We have one of the largest National Guard contingents that's over there, so that's an issue too. So you've got all that as a backdrop, and both sides are trying to energize their base supporters at this point. So all three of the visits tomorrow are in places where one would expect that person's party to do well. Sarah Palin's going to be in Cape Girardeau, which is the hometown of Rush Limbaugh and a very strong Republican area. So she's going to be trying to rev up people there. Obama, by the way, was there about 6 months ago, so I'm curious to see if that had any impact. Biden will be in swing territory just south of St. Louis, Jefferson County, Arnold, which is a suburb of the city, which generally tends to lean Democratic, but it's somewhat more socially conservative than some urban Democratic areas. And then Obama is going to be in Columbia, Missouri, which is kind of like the Berkeley of Missouri. It's the home of the University of Missouri, considered very, very Democratic. It's going to be right on the campus, and they're going to be busing students from other campuses around the state. So that's going to be a huge college-oriented crowd.
Well, and the people in where you are seem to want to hear about health care. But, Dennis, I want to check in with you in Pennsylvania. And you've been covering western Pennsylvania with Democrat John Murtha, who's struggling in his reelection bid. He's a Vietnam vet, we all know, one of the first critics of the war in Iraq. But he caused an uproar in western Pennsylvania when he called it an area that was racist because older people are hesitant to support a black man for president. Your thoughts on his challenge, because you're from that area.
Right. I've watched Jack Murtha for more than 35 years. I mean, I can remember him running for Congress the first time around 1968, I think it was, against John Saylor. Jack Murtha's comment bounced like a grenade because he used the term racist. As soon as he said Western Pennsylvania's racist area, he said, and what I mean by that, he went on to explain that older voters are less inclined to vote for someone outside their group, that older voters are harder to change, that they're more resistant to change. And, I mean, anyone who grew up in the ethnic enclaves of Western Pennsylvania knows that is to an extent true. The problem was, by saying racist area, he offended everybody and quickly apologized and then screwed that up a day later by saying, yeah, at one time the place had been really redneck, which is probably even more anger-inducing among voters around here than just saying racist.
Well, Dennis, so stay with you. I mean, is there anything that Barack Obama, and I'm going to go to you, Joe, with the same question, is there anything that, in this case, in western Pennsylvania, Barack Obama can say that would sway some of these voters?
Well, I think
let's start with Dennis. Yep.
Yeah, I think what Obama has been saying when it comes into Western Pennsylvania is talking about the economy, and the economy is always the number one issue in Western Pennsylvania. It's the number one issue in good times and bad because steel and coal have been such beaten down industries over the years. If the Martians invaded the day after tomorrow and you polled Western Pennsylvanians, they would say the Martian invasion is the number one issue after the economy. So what Obama has been driving on very, very hard is economic message, and that's the most that he can do. That being said, there are polls that suggest that outside of Allegheny County, he could have a very difficult time because this is a place that has been trending Republican in national elections, primarily over issues such as guns, abortion, and gay rights. I mean, those are all flashpoint conservative, socially conservative issues. And in Western Pennsylvania, Democrats are social conservatives.
Well,
go
ahead and finish the flip side, and then we'll go to Joe.
Well, the flip side of it is that in the eastern part of the state, for years and years and years, the Republicans always tried to offset a heavy Democratic turnout in Philadelphia with the four counties that ring Philadelphia on its western borders. And those counties, ironically, now have been voting Democratic in presidential elections, primarily Republican women who are unhappy with the party's position on abortion.
That's Dennis Roddy in Pennsylvania. Joe Manis, just quickly with you there in Missouri, is there anything on the flip side that John McCain can say to Missourians who might be looking at Obama's health care or who might be just, you know, what can he say to pull them into his camp?
Well, I think some of it he has been pushing as far as the socialism thing, which may not play with a lot of voters, but in some rural areas it would. And Missouri has some of the same social issue backdrops that are in Pennsylvania. We've been running a series of stories this week by myself and other reporters talking to voters around the state. And it's no secret, in rural Missouri in particular, race is an issue. And we do have some people on the record saying they won't vote for an African American. So it's and these are people who say that they generally vote Democratic. So there is that.
Well, I'm going to have to
that could affect the race.
I'm going to have to wrap you up there. We just want to take the temperature in your two areas. We'll of course check back in with you. That's Joe Manis from the St. Louis Dispatch in Missouri. Dennis Roddy from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in Pennsylvania. Thank you for letting us take your temperature.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, of course, Barack Obama has his primetime infomercial tonight on 7 networks, and according to reports, part of what he'll be doing is telling stories of struggling families. Meanwhile, Senator John McCain is pumping his resources into a new series of ads focusing on national security and targeting security moms who watch shows like Oprah and The View. Ah, The View. With an audience of 3.5 million, mainly female viewers, headed by Barbara Walters, the show has emerged as must-do TV for candidates, and the show's interviews have drawn praise from Time Magazine, The New York Times, because they're informative and they're fun. Listen to conservative host Elizabeth Hasselbeck and liberal Joy Behar go at it.
Barack Obama actually potentially could have had my vote after his speech at the DNC.
Come on.
You don't believe me?
No, I don't.
Call me a liar then,
no,
Joy.
Not that you're
come
lying.
On, I came here
as
the first
delusional person
to say it was not delusional.
I just don't believe that.
Do you want some more Barack Obama Kool-Aid?
Well, we want to spend just a couple minutes on the so-called soft media today with John Carroll, Here and Now media critic and Boston University communication professor. John, so some real squabbling there. What are they doing that no one else is?
What they're doing is they're bringing their personalities to bear on this political season. And what it is this sort of impassioned kind of choosing up of sides. And it's very clear where the women on The View stand.
Well, but they also, in addition to that sort of sparring that they do every day now, they're also doing hard-hitting interviews, including an October 17th show where John McCain was the one in the hot seat, Joy Behar and Barbara Walters. Don't let him off easy. Let's listen.
There are ads running from your campaign. One mm-hmm. of them is saying that Obama, when he said you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig, mm-hmm. was talking about Sarah. There's another ad that says that Obama was interested in teaching sex education to kindergartners. Now, we know that those two ads are untrue. They're lies. And yet you, at the end of it, say, I approve these messages.
Actually,
do you really approve them?
Actually, they are not lies. And have you seen some of the ads that are running against me?
By the way,
me?
You yourself said the same thing about putting lipstick on a pig. You yourself used the same
when
expression.
I was talking about a health care plan.
Yeah, but he talked about change. No, he wasn't talking about Sarah Palin.
John Carroll, there's a word in that exchange that jumps out at me.
Lie.
Yeah.
It's something that that you don't normally hear during the course of presidential conversation. And this is the test that candidates put themselves to. This is sort of a litmus test that they put themselves to of authenticity and a kind of a reality check for them to go into this parallel universe where there are real conversations as opposed to these sort of stilted, politically based kinds of back and forth, which are very programmed. You see in the debates, you see on the on the Sunday morning shows. This is much more of personal as politics give and take.
Well, and they're getting kudos for it, but, you know, a journalist might ask, well, wait a second, I thought I wasn't supposed to make it personal. Let's listen to one more exchange, and then we'll talk about that. Elizabeth Hasselbeck, who, again, as we've heard, is the conservative on the program, she also put Barack Obama in the hot seat during the primaries over his relationship with Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Obama has since, of course, denounced the Reverend, but at the time he hadn't sort of severed from him, although he denounced the controversial comments that Wright made. We edited his exchange with Elizabeth Hasselbeck down for time. Let's listen.
You chose him again to, you know, marry you, to baptize your children. You named a book after one of his speeches. For 20 years, would you think then, as some have suggested, that that is a lack of judgment on the man? You had no idea? You never heard about these sermons?
The particular ones that you mentioned, I hadn't heard.
But you knew. I mean, you said before his sermons can get a little rough.
Can get controversial and rough.
Absolutely,
but this is beyond the pale.
Do you have a relationship with him now?
You know, I talked to him after this this episode.
John Carroll, Fox TV's Sean Hannity, uber conservative, said that was the best interview of Barack Obama he'd heard, and it was on The View.
That's a bipartisan opinion. Frank Rich is also considered the best interview of John McCain was on The View. They are operating without being hamstrung by those pesky journalistic standards. This isn't a replacement for journalistic questioning of the candidates. I think you can criticize journalistic questioning a lot. The debates were between Barack Obama and John McCain were a bit of a snooze for the most part. This is something that's supplemental. And what it does is it forces them outside of their pre-programmed answers. And I think that that provides a lot of information to the voters. And I think that that's the kind of information that the voters use as much as policy when making their decisions.
Because as everyone points out, you may not watch The View, but it gets amplified. It's on YouTube. It's just rerun over and over and over again.
Exactly.
I just want to briefly touch on another soft media show, David Letterman. Of course, John McCain skipped one appearance and got excoriated by Letterman. Then McCain came back on and got some tough questions. Including several on Sarah Palin.
If I were to run upstairs, wake you up in the middle of the night and say, John, is Sarah Palin really the woman to lead us through the next 4-8 years, through the next 9/11 attack?
Absolutely. She has inspired Americans.
John McCain gave the same answer, but the question mattered more.
The question mattered more. David Letterman has no bias except toward entertainment. I mean, that's what he does. And so he brought out aspects of John McCain that we haven't seen on the campaign trail. And I think a lot of people thought that the McCain who was on David Letterman was realer than any McCain we've seen on the campaign trail throughout this campaign.
John Carroll, Here and Now media analyst, BU communication professor, talking today about the soft media and its impact on this election. And we should say, you know, a new fan of The View, John Carroll.
Absolutely. Thanks, Robin.
Thanks for joining us. Okay, just ahead, a brain bank in Massachusetts that aims to study the relationship between repeated sports-related concussions and early forms of dementia. That's in just 1 minute. And later today, credit derivatives explained and traced back to the banker who created them. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. As the holiday season grows closer, so do requests for donations. But this year, some professional athletes might be receiving a particularly strange request. The Massachusetts-based Sports Legacy Institute, in collaboration with Boston Medical Center, is asking athletes to donate, down the road, their brains. They're building a brain bank to study the relationship between repeated concussions and early forms of dementia. So far, almost a dozen athletes have signed on. Scientists believe their research could unlock the secrets of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Here now is Meghna Chakrabarty has our story.
At the Bedford Veterans Administration Medical Center, just outside of Boston, Dr. Anne McKee is in her lab. She holds up a Petri dish. Inside floats a thin, brown piece of tissue.
Oh, it's very dark brown.
It looks like a piece of seaweed.
It does, kelp. It's actually a 50-micron slice of human brain, and this is actually one from the Sports Legacy Institute.
Oh, it is?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. McKee is holding the brain tissue of former NFL linebacker John Grimsley. The tissue shows evidence of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, a disease McKee says is caused by repeated mild head trauma, most often concussions.
He loved the game. love to knock heads, as he used to say.
This is Virginia Grimsley. John was her husband. They were married for almost 25 years. John died last year of an accidental gunshot wound to the chest, and Virginia still wears his wedding ring on a chain around her neck.
He played from Pop Warner through high school, college, and then 10 years in the pros. 7 years with the Houston Oilers, and then 3 years with the Miami Dolphins.
By the time John Grimsley retired from the NFL in 1993, he'd suffered at least 8 concussions. But Virginia says it wasn't until years later that she began noticing changes in John's behavior. He'd lose his temper, forget why he went to the grocery store, had even forgotten his son's engagement party.
And I started to really suspect that there was something wrong when I saw the HBO special with Chris.
Chris Nowinski is founder of the Sports Legacy Institute, the group asking athletes to donate their brains.
The following is a presentation of HBO Sports.
In 2007, Nowinski had been featured on HBO's Real Sports. Virginia Grimsley says she and her sons still remember this scene in particular.
Gene, repeat the months of the year between January
let's find something else.
And June.
Dr. Robert Cantu, neurologist at Boston Medical Center, was performing a simple memory test on former Dolphins safety Gene Atkins.
Pardon me?
Just pick something else to do, because I can't do it.
Try.
It was pretty frightening to me.
January, May, April.
And the boys turned to me and said, Mom, Dad's already doing some of that. And I said, I know.
Can you do it sequentially, like January, February, March, April?
January, February, March, April, June.
What's before June?
July.
I said, I need to get your dad to watch this as well.
John did watch, but a few months later, he was dead. He had been home alone, cleaning a gun after a hunting trip. And though John had grown up with guns, Virginia says he had forgotten a routine safety procedure.
Maybe he thought he took the last slug out, you know, because you empty the clip and then you make sure there's not one in the chamber. Maybe he thought he did it, and he didn't.
John Grimsley was 45. His wife, Virginia, decided at the funeral home to donate his brain to the concussion research.
So, here we have a microscope.
Back at her Bedford lab, Dr. Ann McKee loads a slide into a microscope.
So we're looking at John Grimsley's brain. You see all those black things?
Oh, yeah.
Those are all neurofibrillary tangles. Those are all tau.
Tau is a protein found in all normal human brains. It's usually in the axon, the long tendril that sprouts out of every brain cell and transmits messages from one neuron to another. But in the brains of athletes with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, McKee is finding tau protein tangled up in the center of individual neurons, and that's what kills the cell.
And this is really pretty easy to see.
Easy to see under the microscope, but the behavioral symptoms often don't appear for decades. The slide of John Grimsley's brain is riddled with dead brain cells.
It's not exactly subtle.
It's like a star field of dark brown spots.
It's right, that's right. This is really almost as bad as an Alzheimer case. It's not the same as an Alzheimer case, but it has some similarities.
Which is why the CTE study is so important and could help people far beyond the football field, according to Dr. Robert Stern. He's co-director of the Alzheimer's Research Program at Boston Medical Center and says the CTE research could lead to new diagnostic tests and earlier treatment for a variety of brain diseases.
But they all have in common this abnormal protein. By understanding further what's going on in CTE, maybe we'll be able to increase our understanding of the other dementia disorders as well.
At the Bedford VA, Dr. Ann McKee also has her eye on helping another group, soldiers.
Absolutely. And blast injuries, you know, you don't even have to be that close to the blast to have a huge shockwave go through your head. Not just a few people, but a lot of people, anybody that's even close to that area.
Thousands of soldiers have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan with severe IED-related traumatic brain injuries. But McKee says untold more walk away from blasts with concussions, and they quickly return to combat.
In terms of knowing what the long-term effects of those mild TBIs, traumatic brain injuries, in military veterans, we really do not have a good handle on that. So we really need to expand into that and try to understand that better so that we can treat veterans as they age and maybe come down with much more serious processes like this traumatic encephalopathy.
And McKee says possibly even prevent it and other forms of degenerative brain disease.
That's Here Now's Meghna Chakrabarty. For more on sports-related brain injuries, go to our website, here-now.org. And staying with sports for one last note, tonight in Philadelphia, temperatures with the wind chill are expected to be in the mid-20s. It's snowing out in the Poconos, but no snow is forecast in Philly, so Game 5 of baseball's World Series will resume in the bottom of the sixth inning. The score between the Philadelphia Phillies and the Tampa Bay Rays tied at 2-2. Philadelphia leads the series 3-1, and eventually someone will win this series, now dubbed the Rainfall Classic. After steady downpours turned Philly's Citizens Bank Park into a mud puddle last Sunday and forced the suspension of Game 5 on Monday. The scheduled startup time for tonight's game is 8:37 East Coast time, right after Barack Obama's primetime pitch to the nation. We'll be back after the news here and now. J.P. Morgan is one of the last giant banks left standing, but it turns out J.P. Morgan actually created the complex financial instruments known as credit derivatives that are largely responsible for taking down other banks. It all started in the late 90s when a Morgan team of whizzes combined two things, derivatives and securitizations. Jesse Eisinger is senior writer for Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. He has exposed the story about J.P. Morgan and is going to walk us through it. Jesse, welcome.
Thanks for having me around.
Okay, so help us through this. First of all,
yes.
We'll start with securitization.
Take a deep breath.
Right. You've told us what securitizations are. That's when things are bundled together and sold.
Exactly. And that had been around in the 70s and had really come to the fore in the 80s when Salomon Brothers bundled a lot of mortgages together and would sell them off in pieces. So you could be exposed to the first losses, or you could wait and try to take the top, which would almost never, they thought, have losses.
I like to think of it as bundled asparagus, which you, if you lay on your at the side these bundled stalks of asparagus and slice through, the top part is the better part, and the bottom part is just the stalks, and that's how they sliced up securitization.
That's a great metaphor. I've used sausage, sopressata in the past, but those little asparagus there, that's a great idea.
Okay, now on to derivatives, which apparently half of Wall Street didn't understand, so it's okay if we don't either. Basically, we understand it's a form of insurance. So tell us about derivatives.
Sure. Well, the basic form of derivative is a side bet. Let's use a metaphor of a football game.
Mm-hmm.
The underlying security is the game itself. The stock or the bond is the game where the Dallas Cowboys play the Green Bay Packers. And you and I decide to make a side bet on the game. That's the derivative.
Mm-hmm.
And the game is played and Dallas or Green Bay wins. And I bet on Green Bay because I'm from Wisconsin,
okay.
And you bet on Dallas.
All right.
And let's say Green Bay wins.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay me.
Mm-hmm.
So the derivative pays off based on the outcome of the game. So the derivative's value is derived from the outcome of the game. So what was happening for J.P. Morgan is they were taking a burgeoning new form of derivative. There were currency derivatives and interest rate derivatives in existence, people making side bets on interest rates and currencies, but they wanted to create side bets on whether companies would default, whether companies would go into bankruptcy or not.
And the way they did that, let's see if we can continue the analogies. You write, J.P. Morgan bundled together loans they'd made to several hundred huge companies and then added some of these side bets, these derivatives, one form is a credit default swap, to the huge bundle. The loans and the bets are now together. Remember, like bundled asparagus. So they then slice up the asparagus and sell these slices. But because they'd added the derivatives, the insurance, J.P. Morgan now paid insurance premiums to the investors who bought a slice, which must have seemed like a good idea to them, until a company in the slice goes belly up, and then the investors lost, and J.P. Morgan, which had paid the insurance premiums, was protected. Brilliant.
It designed the deal in such a way that it was extremely risky for the investors. What's interesting to me is that this deal works for J.P. Morgan, and it spreads risk throughout the system, but it didn't perform well for the investors. And that's one of the new aspects of the story that I really illuminated. And I think that the larger issue here is that what happened in the 1990s was, instead of banks being the repositories of credit risk, the sole sector in which credit risk resided, credit risk now was spread out to insurance companies and all sorts of investors, mom and pop investors, you and me. We all were starting to take a little bit of risk that somebody else would go bankrupt. And the idea from the proponents at J.P. Morgan was that you would spread this risk so thinly that everybody might catch a cold, but no one would catch pneumonia and die.
But instead, you say J.P. Morgan was a possible typhoid Mary of the financial markets. Everybody was, you know, becoming fatally ill.
Exactly. Not just because of J.P. Morgan, but of everything that followed J.P. Morgan and everybody copying this. What happened was we spread so much risk around that people thought that they could tolerate much more of it, took much more loans on. And also, the major aspect is that they could sell the loans, so they didn't really care about their lending standards. And we saw this in the housing bubble. You originate a loan and you sell it really quickly through Wall Street to investors. And what do you care how it performs? Because you don't have to hold that loan for 30 years.
Jesse, is it as simple as saying, you know, that Wall Street pretty much used to buy and trade and sell livestock and corn and, you know, widgets, and now it was buying and selling over and over and over again the risk that somebody was going to pay their mortgage?
Absolutely. What happened on Wall Street over the last 10 years, there was a revolution in abstraction. We got farther and farther away from the underlying commodity, as
right.
you say, or
right.
the stock. And we got further and further into these ethereal, complicated instruments.
Well, you interviewed Bill Demchak, the head of the team at J.P. Morgan that created this credit derivative market. How does he feel now about, you know, it's sort of they created Frankenstein?
Well, generally, these guys feel like this is kind of like the NRA slogan, guns don't kill people, people kill people. I think these guys think that these are tools that were well-designed and well-intentioned, and they were in the wrong hands, used to make mischief. And to some extent, that has some justification, because if you look at Bill Demchak, he's now the chairman of PNC Bank in Pittsburgh. He really cleaned up the mess there, and they avoided a lot of the excesses that most of the other banks in the United States and around the world fell prey to. So he's a really kind of responsible, prudent banker. And that's what I found was so fascinating about this, is that most of the people involved in this project had instilled in them a culture of prudent banking. You know, you would be very comfortable with the entire banking system in the hands of Bill Demchak. But the problem was that bankers, very much unlike Bill Demchak, lost their heads over the last several years. And he saw that coming. He saw that people were making loans that they would never make money on, just to make loans. And so he now is almost like somebody who's having a crisis of faith. He's not ready to say credit derivatives are bad, but I think that there are a lot of people out there who are starting to wonder about regulation and unfettered markets. They're coming around to this notion that has been deeply out of favor in this country for 30 years, which is that a tightly regulated market is a safer market and a more stable market, and a market that you can make more money in over the long run.
Jesse Eisinger, senior writer for Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. Jesse, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
And just a quick reminder, you can always listen to the program stream live on our website or download a podcast. Take us with you wherever you go and re-listen to understand some of these new financial terms. You're listening to Here and Now. The Associated Press is reporting today that military planners now think the U.S. may need 20,000 more troops in Afghanistan. That's double the troop surge the Pentagon had been planning. And this week there were reports that the U.S. is considering talks with elements of the armed Islamic group the Taliban, which once ruled Afghanistan, was toppled in the U.S.-led invasion, and has been resurgent in the last 2 years. One example of that resurgence, a case now before the courts in Afghanistan. Last year, a student was sentenced to death for questioning an aspect of Islam. An appeals court recently overturned that decision but sentenced the student to 20 years in prison for the crime of blasphemy. The case will now go before the Afghan Supreme Court, and our guest John Dempsey will be following closely. Dempsey is a lawyer with the United States Institute of Peace. He's been working for 6 years to reform the Afghan justice system and joins us from Kabul. And John, you were at the appeals court hearing last week. 20 years for blasphemy. Tell us about this young man.
Well, he was a 23-year-old journalism student from Mazar-e-Sharif in the north of the country, and he allegedly had downloaded and distributed some information that was deemed un-Islamic to fellow students who turned him into professors, and then they in turn turned him in over to authorities.
And what kind of information?
There was a report that was authored by somebody outside of Afghanistan and posted online that was questioning the treatment of women under Islam and suggesting that Islam needed to modernize. And Mr. Kambash, the journalist in the north, reportedly distributed that, and some say he may have added some of his own commentary to the report he disseminated.
I think some reports indicated that he also maybe raised the issue of women's rights in class.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a number of professors came to testify at his trial, saying that he was an outspoken student who was often questioning Islam. Their testimony didn't have anything to do with the allegations that he had distributed this material, which was the issue he was being tried for. There was one student who actually testified in his favor by claiming that statements he had made earlier against Mr. Kambash were coerced and that he and his family were intimidated by security authorities in the north.
Well, and how did you feel the first trial where he was sentenced to death for distributing this literature? How did the sentencing go?
Kambash was allowed to defend himself for all of 4 minutes. Was not allowed to bring any witnesses to testify on his behalf, and was denied routinely any of the procedural rights he should be guaranteed. So that was a farce of a trial, and the appeal was moved down to Kabul rather than having it at the provincial court in the north, thinking that justice might be better served and more impartial if they held it in the capital.
Do you think he will go to jail for 20 years?
Well, he's already been detained for over 1 year. The appeals court was delaying and delaying because I think they were under pressure from perhaps from the Karzai government and human rights groups to lift the death sentence, but also from conservative elements to not go light on this guy. I think the international community, particularly the United States, could speak to the president and put some pressure on him to come up with some face-saving way for the government to have him released. And that would, of course, be to the benefit of Mr. Kambash. But that says nothing about the thousands of other prisoners who don't have their trials highlighted by the international media, who are probably suffering equal or worse treatment than Kambash has.
What do you think the perception of justice is in Afghanistan, especially given the resurgence of the fundamentalist Taliban? How's it going, I guess, your work to bring justice to Afghanistan?
I mean, certainly the rule of law has been lagging in Afghanistan, and when there's a governance vacuum in parts of the country, the Taliban seizes that opportunity to go in, and the first thing the Taliban does when they take a district is to implement rule of law and their own brand of justice.
How safe do you feel? What's your life like?
There's been a downward spiral here in terms of the security situation. Violence has increased. The Taliban are reportedly just outside of Kabul, setting up local institutions and essentially knocking on the gates of the city. And this isn't just Taliban or Al-Qaeda threats. There's a resurgence of criminal activity in Kabul now. So whereas 3 years ago I felt perfectly comfortable walking around the streets of Kabul on my own, now I essentially take drivers everywhere. I try to change the routes that I take so that I don't have a pattern of behavior that may become noticeable. And just today, we've put up an additional layer of barbed wire at my house just in case the kidnapping threat that people have talked about is real.
John Dempsey is a lawyer with the United States Institute of Peace. He's been speaking to us from Kabul. John, thanks so much, and please be safe.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's listen to an excerpt of The Overcoat, surrealist Russian author Nikolai Gogol's tale of a lowly clerk whose job, as we'll hear, is its own reward.
It would hardly be possible to find a man who lived so much in his work. It is not enough to say he served zealously. No, he served with love. There, in that copying, he saw some varied and pleasant world of his own. Delight showed in his face. Certain letters were his favorites. And when he came to one of them, he was beside himself. He chuckled and winked and helped out with his lips, so that it seemed one could read on his face every letter his pen traced. If his zeal had been rewarded correspondingly, he might, to his own amazement, have gone as far as state counselor. Yet his reward, as his witty comrades put it, was a feather in his hat and hemorrhoids where he sat.
That's from a new translation just released this month of Gogol's The Collected Tales. It's from Richard Pavir and Larissa Volchansky. Now, unless you're a lover of Russian literature, you may be saying, oh, that's interesting. But wait, remember what happened another time the couple released a book? It sold hundreds of thousands of copies and topped bestseller lists in June of 2004. It helped that Oprah Winfrey picked the couple's translation of the Tolstoy classic Anna Karenina as her book club choice. She said it was filled with passion and soul-searching, an extremely sexy and engrossing read, the Harlequin romance of its day, to which translator Richard Pavir replied, "Who's Oprah?" We recently spoke to Pavir and his partner, Volochansky, and we began with when they first heard of the Oprah pick.
Our editor called and said, "I love telling you this, because you have no idea what I'm telling you." And I said, "Well, try telling me." She said, "Your book has been chosen by Oprah Winfrey." And I said, "Okay, what does that mean?" And she said, "Well, we now have 800,000 copies in print." And I said, 800,000? And Larissa, who was listening, said, 800,000 what?
Because you normally sell how many books in a year?
Well, it depends on the book.
For Anna Karenina, we expected and would think it's very well if we sold 15, 20,000 copies a year.
Right. So here you were vaulted, pole vaulted up the book charts with Oprah's pick. And you heard about Americans reading the book. Tell us that.
Yes, from various people who would see people riding on the subway all reading Anna Karenina, black women commuting from Brooklyn to New York. And they were all reading and even discussing, "What do you think he did then? Why did she do that?" And they were talking about this story.
Well, it's a testament to the power of Oprah, but also Tolstoy, obviously, because they not only read it, but they loved it. But also to how popular your translations in particular are. One critic said, you know, very reader-friendly, but critics also made a point of saying they're the most faithful versions out there. Tell us, first of all, Larissa, what's your overarching approach? What is it that you think makes your interpretations distinct?
We believe that we should try to convey this style as closely as possible, to do it in English. We believe that we owe it to the authors, and we also believe we owe it to our readers.
Well, for instance, I'm thinking of your War and Peace, the Tolstoy work. You kept bits of French dialogue that are in his original text. Others translate the French into English in English translations. Is that what you mean about, you know, you want to keep true to the author?
Well, not just that. That is part of the particular problem with War and Peace. Tolstoy portrays society which speaks French. And then
Russian society.
Russian society which speaks French, and that nation goes to war with the French, with Napoleon, who is their hero. Before he started making war on them, Napoleon was a hero for the whole Europe. So there is this paradoxical situation, a war of two nations, and Tolstoy wants to show how it reflects the situation.
It's an interesting, I was thinking of a remark that was made in the New York Times reading room discussion when they talked about War and Peace. One of the contributors said that by keeping the French, we don't show respect for the reader. And my response to that was, we keep the French because we do respect the reader. Hmm. We think the reader should have what the Russian reader has.
Well, I have different translations here of Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground, and I want to do some comparisons. Let's hear first Jesse Colson. I'm going to take one line but split it. Here's Colson's interpretation. I am a sick man. I am an angry man. Your interpretation, I am a sick man. I am a wicked man. Now, what word in Russian did Dostoevsky use? Is there not a word for wicked? And in other words, how much of this, in this case, is subjective?
Actually, angry is a possible translation, except that this word, zloy, in this case, is a parallel to the word dobry, like wicked fairy and good fairy.
It's really evil and good.
Yeah, Dostoevsky, from the very beginning of the book, poses a moral question. Angry is a mood, you know, you can be angry one moment and not angry at another moment. But wicked is an innate quality.
Almost all the translators say, I am a spiteful man, mm-hmm. which is a slightly different word in Russian, zlobny instead of zloy. Zloy is a very clear, strong word, either wicked or evil.
I see David Margoshak's translation. He uses spiteful, so does Constance Garnett. Yeah. You use wicked. Let's do the second half of the line. Colson writes, I am an unattractive man. I think there is something wrong with my liver. You write, an unattractive man. I think my liver hurts.
First of all, in the Russian, the three phrases all have the pronoun I, ya. But Russian can vary the word order.
No, the third one doesn't.
It does.
Я человек больной, я злой человек, непривлекательный.
Я человек.
Yeah, but it's a different word order, a different rhythm also, because an unattractive man conveys the rhythm very nicely.
Yeah, so your translation, Larissa, is, I am a sick man, I am a wicked man, an unattractive man, without the I am.
Even the cadence is the same. And there is also an added virtue that in Russian the two adjectives are больной и злой. They rhyme. And we have sick and wicked. There is an internal rhyme also which picks up this Russian rhyming.
We're getting a sense of how you two work together as well, because we understand that part of the process is that, Larissa, you come up with, an almost literal Russian to English translation, and then, Richard, you do what with it?
I try to catch the verbal qualities, the rhythms and the sounds and the word orders and as far as it's possible without ruining English. I don't mind if English sounds a little bit Russianized. I like the idea of having English be a little bit influenced by Russian, just as Russian was very influenced by French, and all of Tolstoy's French-speaking Russians, when they speak Russian, speak it with a French accent.
It's funny you mention that you want it to feel almost like it has an inflection, because as a reader, that's what I want. I wish I could read Russian. I can't, but I want it to feel like I am.
Yes, that's exactly right. You should know. I'm reading a Russian novel. It's in English, but it's a Russian novel.
Right.
And they do things a little differently.
Richard Pevere and Larissa Volokhansky are translators. They're also a married couple, and they work together from their home in France where they've been speaking to us. Thanks so much for enlightening us.
You're
welcome. Thank you.